Here we are. This is Real World Radio on air.
The 27th Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, COP27, took place in the Egyptian coastal city of Sharm el-Sheikh from 6 to 20 November. In a press release issued right after the end of the talks, Friends of the Earth International underlined the establishment of a loss and damage fund to compensate developing countries for the irreversible impacts of climate change, despite consistent efforts by the United States and other developed countries to derail it. This fund was one of the key demands of developing countries, and it is a welcome first step that had seemed elusive. However, there is plenty of scope for developed countries to wriggle out of their responsibilities, and other COP27 outcomes were extremely weak, says Friends of the Earth International. My name is José Losegui, and I am pleased to welcome today Mina Rahman, the president of SAM, Friends of the Earth Malaysia, and head of programs of the Third World Network, and Ayumi Fukakusa, climate change and energy campaigner at Friends of the Earth Japan. Both are also members of Friends of the Earth Asia Pacific. How are you, Mina and Ayumi? Welcome.
Hi, Jose.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting us.
Okay, Ayumi and Mina, you both are more than welcome, and thank you very much for being here. I would like to start with you, Ayumi, if it is fine. And I would like to ask you, what are the most worrying results of this COP? And if you could make any kind of reference, particularly to the region that you belong to, Asia Pacific.
Okay, as I am climate change and energy campaigner and focusing on fossil fuel, we saw many push for false solutions by fossil fuel corporates like hydrogen and those false solutions. And taking into account that the next COP is going to be UAE and it's supposed to be Asia COP, right? The Japanese government, my government, is also the biggest fossil fuel financier and investing upstream to downstream, and many projects are in Asia. And there are also many proposals for hydrogen projects in the region. And so it's very worrying. And these developments are happening outside of COP negotiations. And it is, I think, quite a shame that while we are talking about mitigation, adaptation, the loss and damage, the very cause of the climate crisis is not really nearly dealt with. And these hydrogen or CCS gets a lot of attention, gets public subsidies. And also, as I'm from Japan, I was very worried about by seeing a lot of pro-nuclear lobbyists at the COP27. And I think maybe we had more of them than the previous COPs, and Japanese government are strongly pushing to promote nuclear for net zero targets. These elements really worries me.
Yes, Jose, maybe I can jump in as well, Friends of the Earth Malaysia's perspective, particularly also from the region. We will talk more later about the Loss and Damage Fund, which is also very important in terms of a positive outcome for the COP, particularly in the aftermath of the humongous and catastrophic floods that was faced by Pakistan, which is actually going to be not the first in the region, you know, given the kind of impacts we are witnessing, it's likely to get worse. But before we get into that, I'd like to echo what Ayumi just mentioned. Unfortunately, the rich countries pretended that they were very ambitious. They talked a lot about how fossil fuels were not mentioned in the tech, and they were expressing disappointment, including the European Union and the United Kingdom and all, as to why fossil fuels is not there, and they were championing 1.5 degrees centigrade limit. Now, all of this is for people who do not understand. They think that the developed world is very ambitious, but for those of us who are in the process and have been campaigning, this is really hypocritical. As Ayumi has mentioned, much of the solutions that are presented are false solutions. This already began at COP26 in Glasgow, where there was this big push by the United Kingdom for net zero targets by 2050. And so as Friends of the Earth International, we have been very critical of this net zero targets, because which countries ought to have gone to real zero or even beyond zero by now, but they continue to talk about net zero, which is doing too little too late. And much of this is through the false solutions that Ayumi is talking about, not just hydrogen or even there was a push for geoengineering. And this is really scary from a Mother Earth perspective. So there are lobbies, geoengineering lobbies, who are saying that, yes, we need to suck the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So we need to push for removal technologies. This was taking place in the discussion on Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, which talks about carbon markets and so on. So the other false solution, of course, carbon markets. And as Ayumi can tell you, this has opened the door for the biggest con game and offsetting. What they want to present is actually to pretend that they can continue to emit emissions and that they will give money to developing countries on what's called nature-based solutions. This is another false solution. So they think that by planting trees in the developing world, every ton of carbon that they emit can be absorbed by the planting of trees. So pushing solutions like bioenergy, carbon capture, and false solutions like this. So it's more of land grabbing, forest grabbing, and the grabbing of our ecosystems in the name of a solution to climate change.
Mina, I would like to ask you also about these false solutions. Were there any final decisions about them, or these are things that are going to be on the table again in the next COP on climate change?
Well, luckily, Jose, there was already an attempt to push through these ideas. But I think the big problem is that in Paris in 2015, the Paris Agreement had already opened the door to carbon markets, despite all our efforts and also the efforts of some of the governments, particularly led by the ALBA. But unfortunately, in the last hours of Paris, Article 6 was already agreed to, and which is about carbon markets partly and non-markets as well. Now, the problem is that, which was averted in COP27, was a push for classifying what are removals and the kind of false solutions that we were all worried about. Now, what will happen now is there's been an invitation for submissions by parties, which is by governments, and also from civil society and other observers, to bring our views across in terms of what we are worried about, what our concerns are about in terms of these removal technologies, what the impacts will be, particularly for environment and social impacts, including on indigenous peoples and so on. So this is some work that we have to do as Friends of the Earth and our allies in really making the governments aware of the dangers which are coming and where we have to oppose these kinds of false solutions. So this is a battle that will continue on the road to COP28 in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates.
Thank you very much, Mina. In the introduction, we were mentioning this new fund that was established on loss and damage. And you were also mentioning, Mina, while you were speaking. So about that, I would like to ask you, Ayumi, what are the good outcomes of this new COP? I mean, is also there anything else that we would like to underline?
I think, as you mentioned, the loss and damage fund is one thing. I thought that the fossil fuel push is there and it's worrying. But at the same time, I think people's movement demanding fossil fuel phase out and just transition became more visible to people. And it must put lots of pressures on Global North and the fossil fuel companies to make them accountable and to really commit fossil fuel phase out. I really agree that Mina mentioned the hypocrisy. When we go back to my country, like Japan and US or UK, they are saying those things at the international arena, but when they come back to their respective country, they are approving new projects, fossil fuel projects, and providing a lot of subsidies. And I think we really need to put more pressures on government to really take actions. And it was good that that demand became stronger and a bit more visible, I think.
Thank you, Ayumi. I would like to ask you, Mina, if you can say more about the outcomes of the COP, but I was also thinking that you probably would need to explain a bit, what does it mean, loss and damage, to the people who are not used to dealing or listening this technical language?
Yeah, sure, Jose, but before I go to loss and damage, I just like to compliment what Ayumi is saying in terms of the just transition. This is a very important concept, and maybe we need to explain that a bit more before we talk about the loss and damage. When we talk about emission reductions and we talk about fossil fuel phase out, one of the most important foundation and underlying principle is that of climate justice. And what we mean by that, and from a Friends of the Earth international perspective, and which is recognized in the convention, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, and also the Paris Agreement, that the rich countries, the developed countries, have a historical responsibility for the historical emissions that have been started since the Industrial Revolution. And much of this historical and cumulative emissions, which were responsible for the warming today, because gases like CO2 remain in the atmosphere for thousands of years. And so we are facing the climate impacts now. So during the Industrial Revolution, when the rich world became rich because of, you know, if you remember, through colonialism and also through their industrialization, and they were pumping and depending on oil and coal and so on, and they did not restrain them. And then now we know that for limiting temperature rise to 1.5, there is very little carbon space left. And that is the heart of the fight now. Because developing countries have been saying that the rich world has consumed too much of the carbon space, and they've taken much of the, appropriated much of that environmental space. And today there is very little space left, and yet they are talking about net zero by 2050 and so on, which is actually fooling everyone. So having said that, one of the good outcomes in Egypt was actually the recognition of what is called the just transition pathways. There was a decision that there will be a work program to elaborate on what are just transition pathways, because for developing countries in particular, if we have to move away from fossil fuel dependence, of course we must do it, but we cannot just simply do it if we do not have the finances and the access to renewable technologies and others, and also the capacity to do this. So this is in the context of the equity and common but differentiated responsibility, which is so important. So just transition is critical. And for Friends of the Earth International, we have to begin to articulate what exactly that means. And for many of us, we are talking about transformation. If you want to talk about system change, what are the real kinds of solutions that we have to articulate in a way that is just, so that the poor don't have to be the burden, the responsibility doesn't fall on the hands of the poor to actually take on the climate challenge. For instance, if you have large numbers of energy poverty, like in our part of the world, in Asia, if you look at energy poverty in India or energy poverty even in China, you know, last year, if you recall, the big fight was about coal. Of course, we are for the coal phase out. But the problem here is that how do you find the alternatives to actually ensure that those who are dependent on coal, particularly if those are energy poor, are able to make the transition in a way that doesn't jeopardize the poor. So that, I think, is a very important piece of what happened in Sharm el-Sheikh on the just transition pathways. So coming to the loss and damage, just to explain, because we are already facing the adverse impacts of climate change, loss and damage is actually about meeting the impacts of climate change. One part of the discussion is about emissions reductions, and that's mitigation. We talk a lot about mitigation, which is important. But the other part is adaptation, which means that there is the assumption that actually we can adapt to climate change. So for instance, if we are living in the coastal areas, if you find that the communities are vulnerable to seawater intrusion or the disappearance of the coast, you can actually ensure that we reinforce the coastline with mangrove forest, for instance. This is one of the things that Friends of the Earth Malaysia has been pushing very hard. How can we actually make sure that our coastline is climate, you know, resilient? How it can be reinforced? So one of the adaptation response, which is also a co-benefit, which is mitigation, because mangrove forests are both sequester of carbon and they also are very important for strengthening the coastline. So many years ago, when we had the Asian tsunami, the communities that were saved when the big waves came were those who had very good mangrove ecosystems. So this is something that APEC, many of us in APEC, including Friends of the Earth Malaysia, Indonesia, Bangladesh and others, have been focusing on in terms of ecosystem-based approaches to adaptation. So now we come into the area of loss and damage, because there are areas where you cannot adapt anymore. And this is what happened in the Pakistan floods, because one of the things that I attended, a side event organized by the Ministry of Pakistan, and it was shocking to learn that in 2010, when they had a massive floods already, at that time, Pakistan invested in actually building bridges, many bridges in coastal areas, to actually increase the height of the bridge, of the bridges, so that you take into account the level of the rivers. But what they, and this was based on the 2010 water levels. But what they told us now, the Minister of Planning himself had explained that the current floods that happened in this year was so huge that all the bridges that they had built to take into account the 2010 floods could not be saved because the water levels were so high. So we have moved into what even in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is calling in the realm of loss and damage, meaning no matter what we do, it is not enough, because the suffering will be about extreme events like massive floods or slow onset events like sea level rise, which begin to eat up the coast. So this is what we call loss and damage, where you have losses suffered and damage suffered. Like in Pakistan, one third of Pakistan was submerged. 33 million people, which is almost the population of Malaysia, and $40 billion of damages which were faced. Now, no country, that means they are one third of their GDP just wiped out, just like that. So no country can survive with these kind of climate impacts. So this is what is called loss and damage. And the need for a fund was very important. It was a call by Pakistan in the leadership of the Group of 77 and China, where it actually led the developing countries as a united bloc. And as you said in your introduction, Jose, that this actually was the most important unity ever faced by the developing world against the hostile resistance led by the United States and also supported by the allies of the EU, of Japan, of Switzerland, and so on.
Thank you very much, Mina. You already started mentioning some of the consequences that are lived in the region due to climate change. And I would like to ask you now, Ayumi, in a few minutes, if you would like to say a bit more about the consequences of climate change in Asia Pacific.
I think Mina already mentioned a lot, and we saw devastating impacts in Pakistan and other countries, especially in global south. Now the impacts are becoming global. I mean, I live in the global north and we are no exception, but impacts are way much bigger in the global south. And the important fight, or what we have to work on for us campaigners in global north, one thing is that because of the impacts heard in our country, it's really important to communicate why global climate justice is important, why we have to take actions, why solidarity is important. The gap between rich and poor in global north is widening, but the really important principle of CBDR or climate justice, we shouldn't forget about it, and we really have to communicate with people in global north about that. I think Mina mentioned a lot during COP27 and also wrote in TWN report that the equity and the climate justice denied by developed countries during negotiations, and I'm really worrying about it. And I think towards the next COP or everyday campaigning, we really need to ensure the climate justice for our campaign and movement.
Thank you very much, Ayumi. And that leaves me the space for the last question, Mina, which would be, what do we really need to see happen now in the negotiations for a future with any kind of hope, particularly for the developing nations?
I think Ayumi was totally spot on when she talked about climate justice. I think we have to unpack what this means in real terms. And she talked about equity and climate justice from a perspective of the rich world and its responsibility. I think that's really fundamental. But translating that in terms of what is needed. Now, we were very happy that we have a fund agreed to in Sharm el-Sheikh, but the fund is empty. There is no money for in the fund as yet. And so this is the next battle that we will have to fight. And also there's another outcome which is important on loss and damage, which is called the Santiago Network on Loss and Damage. This is a technical assistance facility to actually assist developing countries who need help in terms of technical advice on what to do on loss and damage. And this too, there was a positive decision, because they have set up an institution with an advisory body, and so on, and they also have to have a secretariat and all, but none of this has got money. And this was the biggest fight in Sharm el-Sheikh. No money on the table. The only amount of money that was delivered was a small amount of money for the adaptation fund, which was like $230 million. Now, Jose, this is really, really very small compared to the needs and the scale of what is needed for developing countries. And if you remember, in 2009 in Copenhagen and then in Cancun, there was this promise of $100 billion per year by 2020 that is supposed to be delivered to developing countries. This $100 billion was actually based on Hillary Clinton and President Obama. They did not base, it's just a political figure. It wasn't based on the needs of developing countries. And so even that, the developed countries have not been able to meet. So their promises, they failed on this promise. So coming now, as the years go by, the scale of the needs, and this is just to say that there is a committee in the convention called the Standing Committee on Finance. They actually came up with a report which they looked at all the needs of developing countries. And what was very clear is that the developing countries have identified the scale of needs in the order of $5 trillion to about $11 trillion by 2030. And that is only 30% of it was costed. A lot of the needs, they were not even costed because they didn't know how to cost these needs. And then if we look at loss and damage, that is also a huge amount. So the issue is really of meeting the scale of the needs of developing countries. There's a discussion now which is about the new goal on finance. And this is supposed to be based on the needs. So this is a big debate and a big fight that's happening. But I think what is important to realize is that it's not because there is no money. While everyone recognizes that there are the scale of the demand for moving to a low carbon economy, building a climate resilient future, addressing loss and damage, able to do adaptation, all these are vital for developing countries. Currently, as we know, many of our developing countries are in debt distress. Many of them cannot pay their loans. Even in our part of the world, in Asia, we saw what happened in Sri Lanka, for instance. Of course, a large part of it was the problem of the government of Sri Lanka. But if you look at it beyond, it was also a whole load of problems starting from structural causes, which actually led to Sri Lanka being in this kind of a crisis. So, when you have debt-ridden countries, how these countries going to be able to face the climate challenge, especially when they cannot pay loans? Some of the developed countries are talking about giving of loans. Loans is where these countries cannot repay. You're already in debt. What loans are you talking about? So there was a big push for public money and resources. So coming back to the final point I will make, which is that it's not about no money. There is a lot of money, as we have seen. For instance, the G7, the group of seven richest countries in the world, one study has shown that they actually give fossil fuel subsidies of $100 billion a year to fossil fuel corporations. This $100 billion per year can easily be cancelled for fossil fuel subsidies and transferred to developing countries, to the Green Climate Fund or the Adaptation Fund or to the Loss and Damage Fund. I mean, these are possible, you know, resources that can be diverted. Another example is, for instance, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, last year issued $650 billion of what's called special drawing rights. This is actually a currency within the IMF where the IMF can issue special drawing rights. So this $650 billion was issued mainly because of to respond to the economic and the financial and the COVID crisis. And much of the resources went to developed countries because it's based on quota allocation. But the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres himself has said, and also we had the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Mottley, all of them saying that we can actually have special drawing rights issued for developing countries for them to be able to respond to the climate crisis. So these are options which are there. Also, Friends of the Earth and others, we have been talking about Robin Hood tax, international transaction taxes on speculative capital. So there are many, many options there. And just to say, as what President Hugo Chavez years ago, he mentioned in Copenhagen in 2009, Jose, of Venezuela, he said that if climate was a bank, it would have been bailed out by now. And he was right. So this is about not a lack of money, but it's a lack of political will. And this is climate injustice.
Crystal clear. Thank you very much, Mina and Ayumi. We are coming to the end of our interview today. Thank you both very much for analyzing the results of this COP27 on climate change in Sharm el-Sheikh, particularly from a vision of the south of the Asia-Pacific region. So again, Mina and Ayumi, thank you very much.
Here we are. This is Real World Radio on air.